This is Victoria of the UnleashedHeart.com, and you're listening to Grieving Voices, a podcast for hurting hearts who desire to be heard, or anyone who wants to learn how to better support loved ones experiencing loss. As a 30-plus year griever and advanced grief recovery method specialist, I know how badly the conversation around grief needs to change. Through this podcast, I aim to educate grievers and non-grievers alike, spread hope, and inspire compassion toward those hurting. Lastly, by providing my heart with ears and this platform, grievers have the opportunity to share their wisdom and stories of loss and resiliency. How about we talk about grief like we talk about the weather? Let's get started. Thank you for tuning in to Grieving Voices. Today, I'm very excited to share this conversation with my guest, Marty Cooper. He is the father of the mobile cellular phone. Marty, thank you so much for being here.
My great pleasure.
At the time of this recording, it's been a few weeks since I've seen you on CBS Sunday Morning. And I was just very struck by your story and found myself very curious about you, interested in your story, your personal story. What led you to become an inventor? And just, I really selfishly just wanted to learn more about you. So thank you so much for agreeing to, and I emailed you and you answered and you agreed. And I was just I'm tickled pink. Thank you so much.
What a nice guy I am. it's my pleasure. I like to share my story with everybody. And the fact that you're interested just is an ego trip for me. So thank you.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to actually read, I'm going to start with the description of your book, which is Cutting the Cord, The Cell Phone Has Transformed Humanity, which is about the obstacles you had to overcome inventing the cell phone. And it says that you're one of Time Magazine's top 100 inventors in history, and that you share your inside story of the cell phone and how it changed the world and a view of where it's headed, which I'm very interested in hearing. So while at Motorola in the 1970s, you invented the first handheld mobile phone, but the cell phone as we know it today almost didn't happen. And that's really what kind of your book is about. Maybe let's start there and then we'll kind of even go further back.
Sure. Well, we're talking about the late 1960s, which doesn't seem like it's so long ago because I was an executive at Motorola at the time. So it's not as though I was a child. And yet those were really primitive times. We didn't have personal computers. We didn't have digital cameras. The internet had not been invented yet, believe it or not. They didn't have integrated circuits like we have in our cell phones today. But they did have car phones. And the only problem was the car phones were terrible. If you owned a car phone and you wanted to make a phone call during the day, there were so many people competing with you for this radio channel that we were on that sometimes you'd have to wait a half hour just to get a line if you could get one at all. So and the Bell system, you're much too young to remember the Bell system. Bell system used to be the monopoly. If you wanted a telephone practically anywhere in the world, not only in the United States, you had to go to the phone company. And sometimes they wouldn't even sell you a phone. You had to rent it from them. And there was one color, black. And the typically at that time, most homes had just a single phone. You had a phone in the kitchen. So we're really talking about ancient times. And but the Bell system came up with a way of using the radio channels over and over again so you could have more capacity in a city. You could have more than just 100 people getting service in the city. And so they were promoting this wonderful service, except they didn't believe it was going to be very big. And they had a study done And their study said there were only going to be 1 million people ever using a cell phone. Well, it turns out they were right. That's about the maximum number of people that ever use cell phone in a car. Because we knew at that time that people are basically fundamentally naturally mobile. And now you know that because I'm going to the airport tomorrow. You get the feeling like nobody's where they want to be. Everybody's going somewhere else. After being trapped in our homes by that copper wire for 100 years, the Bell system is telling us, well, we're going to solve your problem. We're going to free you and trap you in your car. Didn't make any sense to us. And we had already made two-way radios that you could hold in your hand. We had watched how companies revolutionized and how they ran their businesses because they now could talk to people moving around. We were not a very big company at the time. AT&T was $22 billion in revenues. We were just $1 billion. And so we took the Bell system on. We went to the FCC, who managed these radio channels that I'm talking about, and told them that we have a better way to do it. And by 1973, it looks like the FCC is about to make a decision, and we're scared to death they're going to do the wrong thing. And if they made the wrong decision, we would be stuck with car telephones for at least 10 or 20 years. So at that time is when I decided, the only way you can convince people of something is to demonstrate the real thing. And so I pulled the team together, and we made a cell phone. And the guys actually built a cell phone in 3 months. We had enough technology around our company, and I had to bend a lot of people's arms behind their backs to get them to stop what they were doing and working on this crazy idea. And in April 3rd, 1973, in front of the New York Hilton on 6th Avenue, I was interviewed by somebody just like you're doing to me now, I was talking on a cell phone. So that is, and 10 years later, believe it or not, that's how long it took to get the government agency to make up their minds. And they did decide in favor of competition, so it wasn't going to be just the Bell system, and the industry was going to decide what the right technology was. And of course, we picked personal phones, handheld phones. And you know what the result is. There are more portable phones in the world today than there are people. Is that an amazing thing? And it's also true in the United States. More cell phones in the U.S. than there are people in the U.S. The number of wired phones, believe it or not, is going down, down, down. There are only a little over 50 million wired phones in the United States today compared to about 350 million cell phones.
It's such an incredible story to me. And I love inventors, the story of inventors anyway. But what you did, though, do you ever just like sit back and pinch yourself? Like, did I really do that? Do you feel like you're living a dream sometimes?
I do, except I said I feel like I'm in a dream most of my life. So I like to think of myself as being a futurist. I'm not a very good executive. We proved that at Motorola, even though I ran a multi-billion dollar division by the time that I left Motorola. But I like to think about new things. I love to take things apart and put them back together. The reason I know so much about the future is because I spend so much time there. I love fantasy. I read science fiction. I have known since I was as long as I can remember, since I was a little boy of 5 years old, I was just desperately interested in everything technical. I wanted to know how things worked. I could take anything apart. I couldn't always put it back together again. But I always knew I was going to be some kind of a technical person, engineer or a scientist. And I guess I pretty much made it. But I have to tell you that, you know, inventing is not the only thing. It's great fun to come up with new ideas. And it's a little harder to come up with ideas that really work. And it's even harder to actually make them work.
Yeah.
So there were many, many people involved in creating the cell phone, the equipment that it takes to make a cell phone work, these cell sites all over the city. I would guess to build today's multi-trillion dollar industry took tens of thousands of people.
I just have to tell you too, the day that I got that email from you that you would be on my podcast was the day that I got my kids their first cell phone plans.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Ironically, that same day.
How old are your children?
16, almost 15, and 12.
Wow. Boy, are you a disciplined mother. My granddaughter, had, of course, it was a special case. She was going to school on a school bus when she was 7 years old, and we were afraid she could get stuck waiting for the bus, and nobody showed up to get her. So we got her a cell phone just for that purpose when she was 7 years old. But your children will very quickly know more about cell phones than either of us.
Oh my gosh. And you know, I find that it's really made my life a lot easier too, and theirs, you know. But I do have a question that kind of leads into that part of the conversation, is that did you anticipate, because I imagine, well, you're obviously a very strategic person too. Did you anticipate that with the cell phone that we would have so much, because there's a lot of negative too, you know, and parents would share that frustration that sometimes the cell phone is like, you know, a sore spot for some families and homes and with their kids and stuff. Yeah. What do you say to that?
Well, certainly there are negatives to every technology that comes along. And the only thing I say about that is I look not in the U.S. and in these developed countries. I look at places like Africa, India, Mexico, where people really struggle just to live. Mm. And the cell phone is revolutionizing those countries. It's reducing poverty significantly. It's bringing healthcare to villages that have never had a doctor before. Allowing collaboration so they can build up their entire economies. So some of these things that we're going through now, and I observe the same thing that you do. You go into a restaurant and you look, here are some kids having lunch and they're all sitting there looking at their phones instead of talking to each other. But I have ultimate confidence in human beings. The cell phone's new, really. It's only been about 20 years since it was widely used, and since everybody had them, and maybe less than that for teenagers. It takes time to figure these things out. Sometimes it takes a generation to do that. But the advantages, the things that the cell phone allows us to do that we couldn't do before, way overwhelm the disadvantages, at least in my viewpoint. So hang on, have confidence in people. We're gonna work it out.
I love that. And I think part of the thing too, when I was watching you on CBS Sunday Morning, is I loved your energy and your optimism. You are just so optimistic. And so what do you see for the future with the cell phone? I mean, because it's changing our clothes, purses, like everything is adapting kind of to the cell phone. So what do you see next? What do you envision next?
Let me start out with your comment about optimism. You're right. I do have a very positive outlook on life, and people laugh at me a lot about that. But I look at the facts, and the reality is that society, all of us, are getting better, and we are better now than we ever have been in every respect. We live longer, we are healthier, we are richer than any time in history. All of the curves are going up. There are bumps up and down, and we have disasters like the pandemics and other things that come along. But on the average, we are better off now than we ever have been. And there's no reason to believe why that can't happen. And the cell phone, not by itself, but it's going to be an important contributor to that. And that's why I emphasize so much, not how much fun we're having in the developed countries with social media and all these other things. What the social media and the games that the kids are playing is doing is making us familiar with an extraordinary valuable tool. So when these kids that are sitting around the restaurants not talking to each other, and by the way, they do end up talking to each other, when they grow up, they are going to be so good at using these tools, they're going to put us to shame, and they're going to do everything more efficiently. And when you do things more efficiently, everybody benefits. And that has been demonstrated, as I mentioned before, in Africa. Cell phone has leapfrogged the wireless phone. Hardly anybody ever had wired phones in Africa. And the one thing that they did, they introduced a way of managing money. Now, that doesn't sound very important to us. We have banks. And it turns out that poor people in Africa can't do that. They can't move money around the country. They can't save money. And somebody introduced a system called M-Pesa that allows them to do all of those things, to save, to transfer money, and to do that just with their cell phone. And so and other things that have happened to make things more efficient have, at least according to a United Nations study, have moved over 1 billion people out of severe poverty in the last 20 years. So that kind of thing is what it really is the basis of my optimism. And the fact that there are villages in Mexico where they have never had a doctor and never will have a doctor, and they now have the ability, because they've got somebody in the village that's got a cell phone that will rent the cell phone out by the minute, and a doctor in Mexico City can treat somebody's eyes in this little village and bring them medical treatment they could never have imagined before. So it's those kinds of things that are the basis of my optimism. You can make all the fun of me you want, but I stand by it.
I wouldn't make fun of you. And actually, it makes me think of where you put your attention and focus. That's what you'll see, right? So if you are focused and have your attention on all the negative things cell phones have brought to us, that's all you'll see, right?
That's a very wise thing you just said. No, I absolutely agree with you. I ought to tell you, I know it's slightly off the subject, but the most important drive in my life, and what I think that should be the drive in everybody else's life, is learning. The reason is kind of obvious if you think about it. Because most kids, as an example, when they get out of school, the only thing they think about is getting a job, making money. There's a lot to be said to having a lot of money and being able to do all the things you want. But it turns out that after you've accumulated enough money to do the basic things and maybe a few steps beyond that, it turns out that the gratification you get from more money kind of starts waning. And it turns out money is not the only thing in life. And the only thing you can keep doing the rest of your life that brings you satisfaction is to learn, to have new ideas, to generate new ideas all by yourself. That's the biggest thrill of my life, is to think about something in a way that I have never thought of before. It might not be original because somebody else probably thought about it, but maybe they didn't. So, and you never, ever get tired of having new ideas and about learning new things. So I put a great deal of emphasis on practicing learning. Now, why do you ask? You didn't ask, but I'm presuming you're going to ask me. Why do you have to practice? It turns out they've done some studies, scientific studies. These are what they call rat psychologists who determined that the act of learning is something that has to be practiced. If you stop learning, just like with your muscles, you lose the ability to learn. Your ability to learn atrophies. So I can't think of anything more scary than that, that you get so self-satisfied, so happy with your position in life, and that you don't think you need to know anything more than what you know now. And you do that for a few years, and it turns out when you want to learn something new, you don't have the ability. Is that scary or what?
Absolutely. I think that like our greatest asset is our minds, and where we, again, it comes back to where we put our attention to. So do you want to focus on growth and learning and advancing yourself in your life? Or do you want to focus on the sad, depressing things that are going wrong, either in your life or in the world around you?
Yeah.
And so where does your optimism come from? Have you always, since a child, just had this sense of wonder and optimism?
Well, I suppose, you know, that the hardest thing to do is to be objective about yourself.
That's true.
I have absolutely no idea. I was blessed with wonderful parents. My parents struggled. They started out in what is now the Ukraine. At that time, it was Russia. They were suppressed in the most awful ways. They managed to work their way to Canada, ultimately to the U.S. They worked hard all their lives, but managed to come up with a comfortable life for all of us. My mother was a dynamo. She never stopped moving. She was a charmer. She could talk to anybody. So I see some great advantages. And I would hope that the only thing that I could do useful in life is to inspire other people to be like my mother was.
I take it then all of your ideas were nurtured, and that aspect of yourself was something that was nurtured?
I put it all down to luck. And the reason I do is I'm not smart enough to figure out why I am what I am. But people have asked me, you know, if you do your life over again, what would you do different? And I have to tell you, I can't think of anything. You change one thing in the past, and there are unintended consequences. So I just think I'm very lucky. And I think, as a matter of fact, that almost all of us are lucky to be around today and to enjoy all these wonderful things that our society lets us do, including you and I, talking to each other virtually as though we were right next to each other. Isn't that amazing?
Right. You know, it is.
We've just met less than a half hour ago, and you could say that we're friends. We have exchanged emotions and ideas. So I think all that's fantastic. And all these kids take all that for granted. And they don't know how lucky they are.
I love that. And it made me think of, too, how even today, as I was thinking about our conversation coming up, I just thought, you know, because I would, as a kid, like I wanted to invent something. Like if I could just invent something. But I would call myself a creator. I'm a creative person. And people, that's how most people describe me as creative. And what is invention but creativity in action, right? And so even just this podcast, it was an idea. I created it. I invented it. I invented Grieving Voices. And so it struck me today. I am an inventor. I may not have invented the cell phone, but I've invented other things. And yeah. I think that's where so many of us kind of forget that as creators or people who create things or bring about ideas into fruition and into their world and into their life for others to enjoy, for others to participate, like this podcast, the microphone I'm using, the computer, like all of it, like creativity is invention.
Yeah.
You know, in action. And so I would just, my thing, message I would like to share with people is that even though you may not be coined an inventor of something like yourself, I think if you created anything, you are an inventor. So what do you say to that?
I say that you're exactly right. Although I have to put some boundaries on that. Every crazy idea that I might have is not an invention.
That's true.
In order to be an invention, it needs a couple of other attributes. It has to be buildable to be an invention, and it has to be useful. So when you talk about what you achieved with your, are we doing what's called a podcast?
Yep.
Yeah. You do one step further, because you know that your podcast is useful. Somebody is getting some benefit. At least I am, because you ask creative questions, but you also execute it, and that's a whole step further from inventing. So I would not only compliment yourself on being an inventor, which you are, but you're also a builder, and we need both kinds, and it's very nice when one person can do both of them. In my case, I was the creative guy. My guys were all creative as well at a different level. But some of the things that my team did, I couldn't imagine doing. I could have done them 20 years earlier when I was sitting on a bench working. But it takes all kinds of skills to do modern kinds of things. And everybody, at least in a technical field, has to be not only creative, they have to be able to put these things to work to actually do things with their hands.
Mm-hmm. So what was the pivotal moment in your life where really everything changed? Or was this like just a natural progression of how your life took shape?
Well, you know, I know you were going to talk about my book at some point, so I'll bring the subject up. I tried. That's one of the points that I made in my book. And there is no eureka moment. There is no one sudden flash of light and the wisdom of the ages suddenly appears. a lifetime that just builds on experience, one experience after another, starting, I believe, before you're born. Mm. You start experiencing things and you're learning. And that's why I keep bringing that word up all the time about learning. There was no way that I could have thought about something as important as a cell phone early in my career. I didn't have the background. I didn't have the technology understanding. So I expressed in my book in several of the beginning chapters about how it takes a progression of increasingly complex thoughts to build up the capability to do something more important. The other thing that I don't necessarily advise for other people, I've never had a plan for my life. All I knew is that I was going to be an engineer, but I had no idea what kind of work I was going to do, what fields I was going to go into. Somehow the world has taken care of me. And I am so grateful for that. I can't express it, which is why I say I'm so lucky. There have been things in my life that have been drivers, we are never capable of doing a total planning for the future. You just have to build up all the capabilities you can and become the person you want to be and hope that you'll be lucky too. And I hope you are too. There's no doubt in my mind that you're going to do great.
Aww.
Well, you didn't have to do this podcast, and I don't know. You certainly are not making a fortune on doing podcasts. I must have done 100 of them since I started. In fact, I was amazed to find out how many podcasts there are in the world today. But it is hundreds of thousands, right?
I don't even know. Yeah. Maybe even millions.
Yeah. So. But somebody must be benefiting. Do you get feedback from people that watch your podcast? Uh, to tell you that they have learned something or that they've been entertained or
occasionally. Sometimes yeah. I feel like it's crickets, you know, but I think that's a good point here to say, or a good spot to say, that it's how you constantly, consistently just showed up for yourself to not give up. Like how, like you didn't give up.
Yeah.
10 years it took. And yeah. I imagine that had some grief in it, thinking like, did you ever have this thought in the back of your mind? Like if this doesn't happen, like all this blood, sweat and tears, you know, you put, cause I know what that's like, you, not to your extent, of course, but to put your heart and soul into something and it bust, or it not come through the way you hoped, right? What do you say to that?
Well, you know, my parents went through that. They had failures in their lifetime. They actually had a grocery store in Winnipeg that failed, and another one in Thunder Bay that failed. And they bought a business in Chicago and that failed before they finally found something that they could do. And it was sheer luck, I think, that they fell into that. So it was a remarkable coincidence that when I was in the Navy, U.S. Navy for 4 years. When I got out of the Navy, I got a job, and then I was approached by Motorola. And amazingly enough, the founder of Motorola had gone through that same experience. He had started three different businesses and had two of them totally fail disastrously. And so when they put up a plaque in the lobby of this fantastic building at the time that I was there, many years after the founding, on the plaque they put out something that he said, "Do not fear failure. Reach out." And I took that seriously at Motorola. Sometimes to a fault, sometimes I'd reach out a little too far, and I had my share of failures. Sometimes I would emphasize the future much more than the present. And when you're running a business, that's not a very healthy thing to do. People depend on your profits to keep going. That was one of the lucky things in my life, to find a place that would tolerate me for 29 years. That's how long I spent at Motorola. And I am not a corporate type. If you know about corporate types, I shouldn't say that. There are people in the corporate world that are very creative. But Motorola tolerated me for all those years, and I'm very grateful for that too.
I am too. As I'm sure millions of people are as well. So I have a couple questions that I jotted down. So I would actually probably say that your answer to this will be yes, and I think you maybe kind of answered it. In your opinion, are tech advances always a good thing? This is actually a question from a friend of mine.
Technical advances, was that the...
Yep.
I have a rule about that. In fact, I have a number of rules of life that I wrote down in my book. By the way, my book is called Cutting the Cord. The cell phone has transformed humanity. I know you're going to remind people of that. And one of the pages I have in the book is what I called the Marty's Maxims. And one of them is a definition of what technology is. And my definition is technology is the application of science to create products and services that make people's lives better. And if it doesn't make somebody's life better, it's not technology. It could be a curiosity. It could be a technical phenomenon. But if it's technology, by definition, it has to make people's lives better. Having said that, there are things that come along that make your lives better, but also have drawbacks. And that's true of almost every technology. It's absolutely true of things like nuclear technology. You know, you look at the idea that we have countries trying to compete in how many missiles, mm-hmm. nuclear missiles they can make. That's a really depressing thought. Yeah, but at some point in our history, our cities will be run by perfectly safe nuclear technology. It's going to be so inexpensive that power is not going to mean a thing to us. We're going to be driving our cars for practically nothing, and heating and cooling our homes, all these things that are so costly today. So sometimes it takes time, and there are drawbacks to technologies. But as I say before, if it doesn't make people's lives better, it's not technology.
I love that answer. Let's see, what else do I have?
What else have you jotted down on that?
Well, okay, so I did have this one thought too, and I wish whoever's like anyone who's listening to this and any inventors, you know how though when you're driving down the highway or interstate or even in the city or whatever, on the street lights, they'll have like that thing. So if you're run a red light, it can capture your license plate.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Great technology, right? Saves a police officer's time. You get a ticket in the mail. It's, you know, so I can't we apply that to the cell phone? So like situations where people are doing like really awful things, you know, especially I was going to go dark a little bit, but you know, like with teenagers and sending pictures or, you know, sex offenders sending pornography, like just things like that, like to be able to track those people. Like when something is, you know, just like when you get a ticket in the mail, when you run a red light, if you do something like that on a cell phone, there's like some sort of data capture. And I mean, I don't know, that's maybe way, way far off thought, but I just thought, gosh, to help make it safer, right? To help utilize it for good, right?
Well, what you just have touched upon is one of the biggest problems in society today. And I'm really serious about that, because the answer to your comment is absolutely. If all you have to do to be perfectly safe is to give up all your privacy.
Mm.
So you've got to make a decision.
That's true.
Are you willing to let somebody else know exactly what you're doing 24 hours a day, every day of your life, wherever you are? Are you willing to let somebody examine what you do, record it all, and knowing that, and knowing that's true of everybody, we'd all be perfectly safe, right? There could be no crime, because we would catch people in the middle of doing it. Well, you know, that's not acceptable.
It's not happening. And it's not happening, right? Yeah.
Well, it can't happen, because we just treasure our privacy. And we also know what happens when you give up your privacy in total. You go and look at what's happened to totalitarian states, because what happens is that the bad guys do get control of that information. And when they control your information, they control you. And they control your ideas, and they control your minds. They control what you can and cannot do. So somehow we have to achieve the right balance. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't suggest that we have gotten anywhere close to that now. The people have been enchanted by this idea of getting stuff for nothing. And I'll bet you do too. You know, you go to Google and they give you a search engine. Mm-hmm. This is one of the most powerful educational tools that's ever existed. And you get it for nothing. No, you don't. You are giving up your privacy. Every time you do a transaction on Google, they get information about you. They know more and more about you. And they use that information for their benefit. Very often it's for your benefit too, but you have no control over it. You to get that free service, you are giving up an awful lot. And the same thing is true with Facebook. And the same thing is true with Twitter. you're getting some satisfaction, you're getting some improvement in your life, but you're giving up your privacy for that. So we haven't figured that out yet. And I think there are a lot of people working on it, including my wife, who is an entrepreneur and inventor herself. One of her latest endeavors is kind of a side issue. She has created an organization that, at least when it's mature, it will be able to put a good housekeeping seal on a company with regard to privacy.
Oh.
In other words, they have come up with standards of privacy. What does a company have to do to preserve the privacy of their customers? And if a company achieves those objectives, then they will have a seal that says that this organization has approved this company from the standpoint of privacy. Because somehow or other, we have to face this this issue of privacy and nip it in the bud. If we keep, if everybody keeps getting enchanted with free services and gives up all their privacy, I think that's a severe threat to our civilization. And I think people are too smart to do that.
I'm glad the conversation went here, because actually just recently, well, with my kids getting their cell phone, right? So a part of it is that part of the caveat was that, well, the ones with jobs have to help pay for those cell phones, the plans, and a part of it too is that I want to be able to find you if you're not home when you say you're going to get home. So iPhone, they all have iPhones. I have an iPhone. You can use the Find My app, right? To find, it'll actually locate their phone, wherever their phone's at. Typically, yes, I understand that their phone can be somewhere where they're not, but as teenagers will, they're going to have their cell phone with them. But there is another app that I had heard about, and I downloaded it and just to kind of test run it. And my daughter, I get home that night and she's like, "So I saw you were driving a little fast today." And I'm like, "What?" She's like, "Yeah, it tells me how fast you were going." Whoa. And it does. And like, it tells me how fast the school bus went, the fastest speed of the school bus, tells me when she left home, when she got to school. Like, if you want to be like helicopter parent on top of your kids, boy, that's the app to have. But I just found it, like you said, I want to give my kids the sense of privacy too. And I appreciate privacy as well. So thank you for bringing that up. I think it's this artificial intelligence that's maybe possibly even taking things a little farther than maybe need be. I just want to be able to find my kids if, you know, they're not home when they say they're going to be home.
Well, you do have an obligation. Somehow or other, you have to make sure that your kids know, first of all, they're not getting something for nothing. Secondly, that there are people that have access to them that they don't want to have access. There are predators out there that are taking advantage of children and pretending that they are something that they're not. Mm-hmm. So your kids do have to be careful and they have to be educated. And I fear that a lot of them are not being educated in that regard. Our schools spend a lot of time teaching kids things that they may or may not need to know, and they forget about other things that are practical things about living. And right. like what you eat and how much exercise is important and how to use your cell phone.
Great segue to you being 92, going to be 93 soon. And
you didn't have to remind me of that.
Go ahead.
On the other hand, reaching 93 has to be an important objective. So go ahead. Please go ahead.
No, I want you to speak to your vitality and to what you just said about eating and exercise and all of that, because obviously that's a huge contributor to your life and to your capability to continue to learn, right?
Well, let me tell you, this is going to be a little hard to do in a couple of minutes, but your body is a complete system. It is not muscles, blood vessels, a brain, a skeleton. It is a system where everything is connected to everything else and everything affects everything else. So you cannot progress in life unless you treat the system as a complete system. So you have to exercise your brain. We've already covered that, haven't we? But you've got to exercise your body as well, and every part of your body. So you need to not only do aerobic, you have to do anaerobic exercise. You've got to really not, upper body has got to be everything. And your digestive system is extraordinarily important in that, because that's how you, you know, that's what your body is. Your body is nothing like a big battery where you take this food in, and it's got this wonderful thing called the digestive system that turns the food into energy. So that whole system has to be exercised in an intelligent way. And we don't learn how to do that in school. They depend upon us to go out in the real world and solve that problem ourselves. So I was lucky enough, and it took until I was almost 50 years old before I became a runner. I took on for about 15 or 20 years, I never touched a bit of refined sugar or refined flour, because I read, I think it was correct at that time, and I still try to do that, that you get an imbalance of sugar in your body, and it causes inflammation, and it reduces your lifetime and makes your lifetime less effective. So there are a whole bunch of rules that people ought to practice that we don't. We as a society, eat too much sugar, and we eat too much in general. And you know, and I'm undisciplined, so the only way that I can get rid of all this food that I eat is to just exercise a lot, which I try to do. It gets harder and harder as you get older, as you might imagine. So discipline is important. I haven't learned that yet, but I'm working on it.
I love that. So what has been one of the greatest lessons that you've learned in your life, aside from that, you know, the body and maintaining all of that, like, just what's some wisdom that you would share with others that you've learned in your life?
Well, I wouldn't call it wisdom, but an important part of my life is interaction with people. If my presumption when I meet somebody, including you, is that I'm going to pursue this relationship and learn what I can, because everybody has something to teach me. And I have found that to be true. Even people that I, in your case, I don't have any problem. I think you're charming. I've met people that are offensive, and yet when I engage with them, I find out they have skills or they have knowledge that I don't have. And I try to be as open-minded as I can. Other side of that coin, however, is that when I do find people that have things to contribute, I treasure that. I'm so fortunate to live in a city like San Diego, where we have a number of universities. And when I get to meet people in these universities and exchange ideas with them, that is the cornerstone of my life. And I can do that every day with my wife, who is a great deal smarter than I am. So all of those things are so important. You cannot live a life by yourself. We live in a society, and the exciting things about life do involve collaboration and appreciating each other.
I love that answer.
It's much too long an answer for such a nice short question.
No, it seems like connection. Connection is, you know, yeah, it's about connection.
Yeah.
And just like we can grow through connection, we grow through grief too, which is what my podcast is all about. And so what has grief taught you in your life? And what are some of your grieving experiences that have helped you push through some difficult challenges in your life?
Well, I always try to think about the issues that cause grief in the context of what was positive before the grief happened. So I never talk about the difficulties my mother had. My mother lived until almost her mid-90s. And I talk about how wonderful she was and how much she contributed and how she even, my mother was selling dresses when she was in her late 80s in a dress shop, particularly. Wow. Not because she needed the money, but she wanted to keep talking to other people. So I think that an understanding of how important it is to have people in your life is probably one of the most important things in my life.
I love that. And I saw too that you were, thank you for your service as well. I'm a veteran and
how
I saw
you?
That I am. And I saw that you were in the Korean War. And can you share anything about that experience?
I was in active duty in the sense that we were trying to blow up North Korean railroads and things of that nature. I was in the submarine force, and we did an awful lot of practicing to be ready for something, but I was never in a shooting war. Nobody ever shot at me, and I'm very grateful for that. I appreciated the service for a number of reasons. And one is they put me through school, and I'm not sure I would have been able to go to university without the Navy's help. And the second thing is I've always been somewhat immature. I'm still working on growing up, but they did help me grow up. They taught me about discipline, about responsibility, about keeping your word about things. So I learned a great deal in the Navy, and I would recommend that to everyone. I think what they do in Israel, where everybody has to serve for some period of time, is a very useful and productive thing. And leniency is for most people. Some people grow up sooner than others, but it's an experience that everybody ought to have. The other side of that coin, however, is that I wish we didn't need armies or weapons. I find that is so, if you're a builder, if you're a creator, and you want things to get better, we certainly do better cooperating with each other than we do fighting. So we're more efficient if we don't do it. Think of all the money we spend and all these weapons when we could be working on tools for improving productivity. So I wish we didn't have to have armies and people would learn how to talk to each other. I'm afraid we are some generations away from that. But if education keeps getting better, at least in the free societies, I think that we are going to learn how to get by without armies. And I only hope that we can make all the societies in the world free like we are. Meanwhile, we should be glory in our independence. We've got a lot of problems. I don't suggest that it's all a bed of roses, but it's all fixable. I think we're lucky to have a society where we can complain about things, we can argue with other people, and yet everybody can speak their minds, don't you?
Absolutely. Would you say that is one thing that maybe breaks your heart?
I'm sorry, one thing that makes...
Would you say that that's maybe one thing that breaks your heart?
Oh, yeah. And irrationality breaks my heart. When people have ideas that just don't make any sense at all, and they deeply believe in it. That is heartbreaking to me. And that is the basis of intolerance. It's the basis of warfare. There's people just not thinking it out. If you think it out and work things out right, there's always a solution that is more efficient and better than fighting or being intolerant.
Well, it comes back to what you said earlier in being willing to learn from others.
You bet.
Being open to learning.
You bet. You got it. No wonder you could make the big bucks.
Yeah, maybe someday. I get a feeling, though, like the crux of your message, like the main part of your message is that learning is everything.
It's the foundation.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, you have to execute. So having all the information is not worthwhile unless you actually put it to use. But without that, there are no uses that you can do. There's nothing you can accomplish without having the basis for doing good things. So I'm good. That's the one thing I got from this thing. I haven't used that term before, but learning is the foundation of life.
That is your quotable for this episode.
It is.
What is one thing that you would like to share with someone listening that maybe has a dream or lost a dream or maybe hasn't allowed themselves to dream just because of their circumstances in life? And you've kind of touched on a lot of different points, but kind of put it in a nutshell, what you would say to them, how to get out of that space, that headspace, and get back to dreaming again and believing. I think it comes back down to faith too, right?
Yeah. That's the first question you've asked that I can't respond to because I can't envision, I can't put myself in somebody's shoes that is totally negative, doesn't have a vision of the future of how things could get better. And there's really no reason to do that because I know people at all levels of life that have optimistic viewpoints. Whatever they do, they want to do it well. And sometimes they're menial tasks, but they somehow take pride in what they're doing. And if somebody doesn't take pride in what they're doing, if they don't have ideas, if they don't think about things that bring them pleasure, I feel so sorry for them. I tell people, boy, if you got a job where you never get any satisfaction, go do something else. You're entitled to be able to have your own ideas, to get satisfaction out of it, to get a thrill out of a new idea. And if you don't do that, shame on you. You can go find something else to do and live a much more productive life.
What I hear in you saying that is that look at who you're surrounding yourself with.
I suppose you're right. Well, you sounds like you're more selective than I am. I surround my wife keeps telling me, you know, I don't like so and so, and I say, well, they're not so bad. I learned such and such from them. So, I'm just very lucky. I just run into more interesting and fun and people that teach me things. So I don't want to make rules about how selective I should be. You don't want me to be a snob or an elitist, do you?
But I think it comes down to too. It's being if what you're focusing on is wanting to learn from people, you're going to learn from all kinds of people. You're going to look for those people to learn from, right?
You bet. You got it.
What is the one thing that brings you the most joy and hope for the future?
Wow. Oh, that's another really hard question. Now I'm going to have to duck that one only by talking about I now have a great-granddaughter, would you believe?
I never thought I would.
And I have another family that's got a baby. In fact, I guess I have three babies in my life of very close people. And when I see them growing up and how fast they're learning, and how much I admire their parents and how they're raising these kids, because they've got advantages that I never had and that my children never had. I guess that's my biggest hope for the future. They are going to get educated better than I was, than my children, even my grandchildren. And they, that's our hope for society. If society doesn't get control out of some of these things that are on the verge of getting out of control, our society, the civilization's not going to last much longer. And that would be a shame with all that we've accomplished so far. So it's the coming generations that I think are great, and we should be doing everything we can to make their world a better world than our world was.
I love that. I'm going to put you on the spot for one more question. So being the futuristic thinker that you are, and being 92, going on 93, often living in the future, what do you think about for the rest of your days? What do you want that to look like?
You know,
what comes to mind when you think about that?
Obviously, you're not paying attention. I told you at the beginning, I've never been able to plan out my life.
That's true. And
I am struggling at the moment, trying to figure out what my next career is. And I haven't quite worked it out. You know, I spent a lot of effort writing my book, and I was focused on it for a number of years, and that's over. And I'm very satisfied with the book. I wish another million people would have bought the book, but I told my story, and that was my objective. And I'm trying to figure out what to do next, and not entirely clear. I've got tentacles out trying to look at things. I've been studying how the human brain works. I wear hearing aids, which are totally unsatisfactory. And I am working with people in the universities trying to improve that industry. So I haven't totally figured it out yet, but I am going to come up with another career. And it will be focused on the things that I know how to do. How do you put things, existing things together in different ways to make people's lives better? That's how we started a conversation, and it's a good way for us to end.
Well, and I'm going to put a bug in your ear on that one. Forgive the pun, but actually there was an incident where someone I know had lost their hearing aid at a campground. And we were looking through the grass to try and find this hearing aid. And it's like, you know, they have apps and things where you can find your keys and ways to do that. How come there isn't this artificial intelligence in your hearing aids that you can pair to your phone? So if you lose your hearing aid, you can find it, especially something that costs like a small car. Like you can, they're very expensive, right?
Yeah.
So that's
an invention.
Yeah.
And by the way, you did just do an invention. It is possible to do find my hearing aid. A much better solution would be to make the hearing aid so inexpensive that if you lost it, you could just get another one, and it would be. And that really is what I'm working on now. If you look at a pair of Apple earbuds, the technology in these earbuds that cost about $200 or $300 is not very different than this $6,000 pair of earrings that hearing aids that I wear. Something's wrong with that, and I'm really working very hard on that, because not only are they too costly, they don't work all that well. But I'll keep in mind your comment to it when we get to the stage of actually doing something, even losing, if a hearing aid costs $100, you ought to be able to find it. Yep. And there is no technical reason why you couldn't do it. If you can find a cell phone, you can find a hearing aid. So I'll try to remember to put your name on the patent if we ever invent something. You're now a multiple inventor.
Oh, that would be amazing. And you know, thank you so much. I know you have to go. Thank you so much for your time today, for your wisdom. I'm going to put everything in the show notes.
No, it's my pleasure. Great to talk to you. You're a great interviewer and very good questions. And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Great to see you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And remember, when you unleash your heart, you unleash your life. Much love. From my heart to yours, thank you for listening. If you like this episode, please share it, because sharing is caring. And until next time, give and share compassion by being a heart with ears. And if you're hurting, know that what you're feeling is normal and natural. Much love, my friend.